Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 14. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 33. We will entitle this, Absalom Returns to Jerusalem. Our context is this. Absalom had murdered Amnon, his brother, because Amnon had killed Absalom's full sister, Tamar, in the last chapter, chapter 13. It happened at a sheep shearing festival at Baal Hazor. After the murder, Absalom had fled north, had gone east of the Sea of Galilee, present-day Golan Heights, to the kingdom of Geshur, where his grandfather Talmai was king, and where his mother Maacah had come from before she married David. So Absalom is in exile at this time, and so now in this chapter, chapter 14, we'll see how he gets back to Jerusalem. So we start in 2 Samuel 14, 1 through 3. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments now, and do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days. Then go to the king and speak to him in this manner." So Joab put the words in her mouth. Now, why was Joab so hot to get Absalom back? Well, here's several reasons. First of all, it would establish Joab in David's favor, because David would be reconciled to his son, which we see from later on. We know that that's the case. He wanted to be reconciled to Absalom, and Joab would have been an agent to do that, and so that would make Joab look good in David's eyes. Because remember, Joab and David didn't get along too well. Also, Joab, by bringing Absalom back, would please the people. Now, John Gill says the people were Absalom's darling. Well, on the other hand, Jameson Fawcett Brown says they think that the fear of public opinion would inhibit David from reconciling. Well, either the public opinion is in favor of Absalom and would want him back to get reconciled, or they were opposed to Absalom and would not want him to get reconciled. Those two ideas are directly contradictory. So it could be that there's some of the people that wanted Absalom back and some of the people who did not. But at least it would please some of the people if Joab managed to bring Absalom back, which would give Joab some political credit. Another possible reason why Joab was so hot to get Absalom back is Joab might have been afraid David was going to go up to Geshur and do some justice by executing Absalom, which is what he should have done to start with. He was a cold-blooded murderer, premeditated murderer. David didn't do that. Joab could have seen that David was still angry at Absalom, and so Joab might have thought, "I better stop this. We don't want to have another king's heir to the throne executed. That's really going to cause a civil war." So Joab might have been thinking, "Well, let's just start nip this in the bud. Let's have the father and son get reconciled so that there will be peace in the kingdom." Now, why would anyone think that David was going up to Geshur to execute Absalom? Well, it would depend on how you translate verse 1. Now Joab the son of Zeruiah perceived that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. Inclined toward Absalom. Well, the rabbis actually say that that means that David was inclined to go up there and bump him off and whack him. I don't think so. But if that were true, then yes, Joab wants to stop David from doing that. Well, that's a little speculative. I think it's easier just to say he wants to get Absalom back for political reasons. Reconcile the kingdom, be a big shot. Henry Kissinger bringing the Chinese and the Americans together in the 1970s. A peacemaker and a big shot in the kingdom, and David would be more in his debt. I think that's the real reason why he went up there to get him. Now, Joab is called here the son of Zeruiah. Zeruiah was David's sister, and Zeruiah was the mother of Joab's brothers, Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel have showed up in our story earlier. Asahel's dead now. And so we see that we're still talking about a family affair here. Joab is David's nephew. Must have been a lot of tension in the family. There was a lot of tension in the family. So in verse 2, Joab sends to Tekoa. Now Tekoa is a place that's about 4 miles or so to the south of Bethlehem, a little bit to the southwest of Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is about 4 or 5 miles south of Jerusalem. So it's a place down there in the tribe of Judah. Easton has it about 12 miles south of Jerusalem directly. As the crow flies, I guess, that's about right according to my BibleAtlas.org map. This was also the birthplace of the prophet Amos. That might be why you've heard of Tekoa before. Now, this woman from Tekoa is described as a wise woman. John Gill says she was, quote, a woman of good sense and of a good address, apt at expression and reply, and knew how to manage an affair committed to her, and among other things, perhaps, was famous for acting the part of a mourner at funerals. Well, Gill gets all that from the story we were about to read of how she comes up and gives this cock and bull story to David, and she's pretending to be a mourning mother, and she was pretty sharp, really sharp, to pull off a stunt like this. I couldn't have done it. So that's why she was called a wise woman. Now, this deception of the king that we're about to read about was a success. Here's some reasons why. First of all, she was a widow. Her condition of life was the better calculated to excite compassion. And so when David looks at her, he's going to tend to believe her because she looks like she's a mourning widow. She lived at some distance from Jerusalem, so there was less danger of detection if she'd have been a widow from Jerusalem. She was advanced in years, and people tend to sympathize with old people. I don't know why, how we know she was advanced in years. We know she had two grown sons. She was wearing mourning dress when she went to see David. This, of course, heightens the idea of a woman in distress, and you know how men are about taking care of women in distress. Plus, she did not make the similitude of the parable too plain. The similarity of the events of her fake story with David's situation. If she'd have just come out and made it plain, David might have said, oh, you're trying to trick me, huh? I see what you're doing. She didn't do all that. And so she is well primed to pull this stunt off that Joab has put her up to. We go now to 2 Samuel 14, verses 4 through 7. Now when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, help, O king. The king said to her, what is your trouble? And she answered, truly I am a widow, for my husband is dead. Your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them, so one struck the other and killed him. Now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Thus they will extinguish my coal which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Now it's interesting, in verse 5 she says, truly I am a widow. Well, truly, this is a cock and bull story made up by Joab. Now, some people try to save her honor, to save her from lying, say that very possibly Joab found a real widow whose circumstances matched the fable. I don't believe that. Not for a minute. She's making this up as she goes. The story goes, she had two sons struggling together in the field, got in an argument over something that makes it look like the killing was not intentional, but in self-defense. And that, of course, if you make the parallel, implies that Absalom had good reason for killing Amnon. In other words, self-defense is a good reason for killing somebody, and justice, like a kinsman redeemer, looking out for the honor of your sister who's been raped, it would have been a good thing. It's perfectly understandable that Absalom killed Amnon. And so she's making the details of the story fit pretty good with David's situation. And then she says there was no one to separate these two struggling brothers. This might be a hint that David was there. He could have separated Amnon and Absalom if he'd have been a little bit more alert, but he didn't do it. So one struck the other and killed him. And, of course, the parallel is Absalom struck Amnon and killed him. Now, verse 7, she says her family's getting on her case. They've risen up against me. Hand over your son that killed his brother. Now, who would that family be? That would be the next of kin avengers. That's what they did back then. They didn't have a police system. They didn't have any of that. And so somebody kills somebody, it's up to the next of kin to do justice. And so they were looking to do justice. However, they might have had a different motive. If they had killed the murderer in the story, they would have inherited anything that was left because there was no other brother to inherit. The husband, of course, is dead already. He couldn't inherit. He was dead because she's a widow. In the story, she's a widow. And this is the last son. So she says, they will extinguish my coal. That last burning ember of her life will be gone. And so that means the Avengers of Blood here might inherit money if the heir was dead. The murdering brother was dead. Now, the insinuation here is that those who wanted Absalom punished by death had interested motives. Yes, people are going after Absalom. Maybe you too, David, but, you know, people that are going after Absalom are not looking for strict justice. They're looking for some money they can get by what they can inherit. Now, admittedly, this is seeing a lot into this parable. It just depends on how crafty and wise this wise woman of Tekoa actually is, but it could be that all these details of the story are meant to bring out something to David. At any rate, in verse 7, when she says, "They will extinguish my coal which is left because there are no more heirs," that departs from David's story, as John Gill points out, because David did have other sons to keep the family name alive if he had decided to execute Absalom. We go now to verses 8 through 11. "Then the king said to the woman, 'Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you.' The woman of Tekoa said to the king, 'O my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me and on my father's house. But the king and his throne are guiltless.' So the king said, 'Whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you any more.' Then she said, 'Please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood will not continue to destroy. Otherwise they will destroy my son.' And he said, 'As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground.'" In verse 8, David tells the woman to go to her house. Why? David was probably going to send someone to inquire into the truth of the story. That makes sense. He's not just going to take her word for it. And of course, if he'd done that, that would have exposed the woman's story as false, and the whole scheme of Joab would have fallen to the ground. Notice he says, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." That giving orders means I'm going to investigate. So, as John Gill and Adam Clark say, the woman doesn't leave. She continues to speak because she wants an immediate verdict of innocence for her murdering son, at least her fake murdering son. She wants a verdict of innocence so that David would have then pronounced by his own lips the innocence of his son Absalom. Now, she says something here that's a little bit hard to interpret. She says, "Oh, my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless." Well, what in the world does that mean? Well, I'm going to give you three options, all of which make sense. The first option is, she's saying, "Let the blame fall on me if I've told you a lie in this case. Oh, my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me if I'm lying to you. And if you go out and excuse my son's murder and prohibit the kinsman avengers from killing my son, and in fact, if you carry out a miscarriage of justice, the fault's mine, not yours." Now, Jamin Fawcett Brown goes along with that, and let me read you a quote backing that up. She said, "The woman's language refers to a common precaution taken by the Hebrew judges and magistrates solemnly to transfer from themselves the responsibility of the blood they deemed to be shed, either to the accusers or the criminals. And sometimes the accusers took it upon themselves." In other words, "Hey, judge, I know I'm innocent, and I'm going to convince you to give me a judgment in favor of me. But if that judgment is wrong and you go out and you put into jail the person who has stolen my property, or if you go out and execute the person who executed my loved one, I'll take the blame for it because I know he's guilty. If he turns out he's innocent and I'm wrong, well, then it's my fault, not yours." I think that's probably what's going on here. Second option as to what she meant, she's saying, "Let the king be blameless if he should forget the affair. Oh, my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house for bringing all this up. But you are guiltless if you just forget about it and let the kinsman avenger do his work." In other words, the fault that my son gets executed by the kinsman avenger would be my fault, not yours, if you decide to be quiet. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. That's John Gill's idea. Notice how she's very respectful to the king. She doesn't want the king to put the case on hold in order that the king had time to investigate, so she continues her pleading. But she is giving a tacit reminder that an injustice might be done should the king fail to act. And say, if you're not going to act, okay, well, let the guilt be on me. Well, that by implying that the guilt might be on her, she is implying that guilt might be done. And why would that happen? Because the king decided to be quiet and not do anything about it. All right, well, that's option number two. Let the king be blameless if he should forget the affair. Option number two. Option number three. Don't let blame fall on the king should people criticize him for not letting the avenger do his job. In other words, if the king prohibits the blood avengers from killing the murdering brother, then the woman is saying, well, that would be my fault. I was the one that put you up to this, king, so don't let anybody criticize you for stopping the wheels of justice, for stopping the kinsman avenger from doing his job. Well, it's not really clear what she meant, but those are three good options. But the whole point is that she's making whatever she meant exactly, she's making, look, I'm trying to make it easy on you, king. Whatever decision you make, whatever you do or you don't do, whatever happens is going to be on me, not on you. Now notice the king says in the last part of verse 11, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. That's an oath. As the Lord lives. David said that all the time. He's always swearing by God's name, but I guess it was okay because he meant it. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 12 through 14. Then the woman said, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. The woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, and that the king does not bring back his banished one. For we will surely die and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one will not be cast out from him. Well, she pulls her veil off and she basically tells David, I've been telling you a story here, a fable, to try to get you to see something. And she's pretty direct. She says, O king, why have you planned such a thing against the people of God? Who are the people of God? Well, it could be Israel. I think that's what it is. It could be just Absalom and his men are people of God. I think she's talking about the whole kingdom, because the kingdom is in political trouble when there's a threat of civil war coming out from Geshur. She said, O king, you are guilty. Jameson Fawcett Brown say about that, the whole nation will have cause for saying that the king shows more attention to the petition of a humble woman than to the wishes and desires of a whole kingdom. The death of my son is a private loss to my family, while the preservation of Absalom is the common interest of all Israel, who now look to him as your successor on the throne. And I think that's what she's meaning. She's saying, hey, you're screwing up the whole kingdom by planning such a thing against the people of God. In other words, by not showing mercy to Absalom and by bringing him back to the kingdom. Now, she says another opaque thing in verse 14. She tells David, for we will surely die and are like water spilled on the ground. What in the world is she talking about here? Well, here are two options, both of which make sense. The first is from Ellicott. She's referring to how quickly heirs to the throne will die. She's worried about there not being an heir to the throne. Amnon's dead. Now you're going to banish Absalom, so he's gone. I don't know who would be next in line. Might be Adonijah. I don't know, but he might die too. Any heir that comes afterwards might die too. And so she's saying, look, heirs are hard to come by. They die. It's just like you break a pitcher and spill water on the ground. You can't get them back. And here you are, getting rid of one of your heirs. Well, that makes reasonable sense. That's from Ellicott. Here's another option from Benson, the commentator, who says that the woman is referring to the fact that Amnon is gone and nothing will bring him back. She's assuming that Amnon, although murdered, was deserving of what he got. Justice has been done on him. He's already gone. Good riddance. And so let's move on. And Absalom was the one who executed the judgment. Amnon would have died anyway, so why punish Absalom for it? However Amnon died, he would have deserved it for what he did, so why are you going after Absalom? He's just carrying out justice. Let me read what John Gill says about this. For his crime, Amnon, he justly deserved to die, and thou, in this case, didst not administer justice. Horrible as this fratricide is, it is a pardonable case. The crime of Amnon was the most flagitious, and the offense to Absalom, the ruin of his beloved sister, indescribably great. In other words, we all die, we will all surely die, just like Absalom died, and he deserved to die, and he's gone, that's great. So don't come after Absalom. Well, if I had to choose between those two options, I think that basically that the option, the Benson option there, that she's just referring to Amnon dying like he deserved to die. I don't think that's what it is. I think what she's saying is, we're not going to have an heir to the king, to the crown, if you keep this up. And so she speaks for God. Yet God does not take away life. Well, yes, he does. Remember Nadab and Abihu? God takes away life a lot of times. She's speaking for God a little bit presumptuously, I would say. But plans ways so that the banished one will not be cast out from him. Well, so that's great. Speak in the name of God. Nowhere says she was a prophet in the text. Nowhere says she was right. So now the wise woman of Tekoa continues in 2 Samuel 14, 15 through 17, continuing to explain to David why she came with this cock and bull story. Now the reason I have come to speak this word to my lord the king is that the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, let me now speak to the king. Perhaps the king will perform the request of his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God. Then your maidservant said, "Please let the word of my lord the king be comforting, for as the angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and evil, and may the Lord your God be with you." Now the woman says in verse 15 that she's afraid of the people. Well, why would the people make her afraid? Here's some possible reasons. She could have heard rumors of an insurrection in the nation in favor of Absalom. Let's bring Absalom down from Geshur and make him king and kick David out. She might have heard rumors of an invasion of the nation, Absalom invading the country with the support of the king of Geshur, a military invasion rather than just a domestic insurrection. That might have been what she might have heard. She might have heard disputes about succession to the throne. Who's going to take over? That's always a hard thing, of course, in ancient times of monarchy, is succession to the throne. And so what she says here is quite reasonable. She would have reason to be afraid because of the strife between Absalom and Amnon. And verse 16, the woman is referring back to what she had said earlier when she came to David. She said, "For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God." That was referring to her story, not what's really true on the ground, but she's just saying, "That's what I was saying to myself. That's what I was going to say to you, David, when I came." She's not referring to that as truth. And so she openly admits that this was a parable in order to get David to do what she wanted him to do. We go now to 2 Samuel 14, verses 18 through 21. "Then the king answered the woman, 'I'm going to ask you something. Don't conceal it from me.' 'Let my lord the king speak,' the woman replied. The king asked, 'Did Joab put you up to all this?' The woman answered, 'As you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or left from all my lord the king says. Yes, your servant Joab is the one who gave orders to me. He told your servant exactly what to say.'" Your servant being the wise woman of Tekoa. "Joab, your servant, has done this to address the issue indirectly, but my lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God, or an angel of God, knowing everything on earth." Then the king said to Joab, "I hereby grant this request. Go bring back the young man Absalom." Now, verse 19, when David asked the woman, "Did Joab put you up to this?" the woman answered, "No one can turn to the right or left from everything you say, king." In other words, what she's saying is, "You've asked me. I can't turn to the right. I can't turn to the left. I've got to answer truthfully. Yes, he did. He put me up to it." As John Gill says, the woman is saying, quote, "He, David, has hit upon the truth of the matter. There is no dissimulation or prevarication to be used. The thing cannot be denied." Verse 20, Joab, the woman says to David, "Joab, your servant has done this to address the issue indirectly." In other words, through a parable, through a story, rather than just going up to the king. He said, "You know, king, you're an idiot for not pardoning Absalom. King's not going to take that too well." So this is pretty crafty on the part of Joab and the woman. Now, in verse 20, the woman of Tekoa gets a little carried away and says that David has the wisdom of an angel of God. Well, actually, the Home Christian Study Bible says he has the wisdom of the angel of God, and the A is capitalized. That, of course, in the Old Testament, I believe every time you see that, it's an epiphany of Jesus. But I don't know if the wise woman of Tekoa would be aware of the angel of God. Maybe so. I don't know. But I do know that other translations translate it differently. The ASV, the New American Bible, and the Darby translation say, "An angel of God, my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of an angel of God." And I think that makes a lot more sense. The Young's Little translation says, "My Lord the King has the knowledge of," quote, "a messenger of God." Well, an angel of God is probably best, I think, there. In my humble opinion, it's a minor point. Doesn't really matter. Now, David said to Joab in verse 21, "Joab, go bring back the young man Absalom." Why young man? John Gill say that some say that David here is trying to extenuate Absalom's crime. He's hinting that it was done in the heat of a youthful passion. This young man, he didn't know any better. He just got mad. I think that's a stretch. Reading too much into the text here. So we go now to 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 22 through 23. "Joab fell on his face to the ground, prostrated himself, and blessed the king. Then Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord the king, and that the king has performed the request of his servant.' So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem." Now, why was Joab so hot to get Absalom back? Well, there's two possibilities: political reasons or personal reasons. politically, it would be good to get Absalom back, because so long as Absalom was alive and unreconciled to David, the threat of civil war hung over the kingdom. In my opinion, that was probably Joab's main motivation. He's trying to stop a civil war. And not only would he help stop a civil war, but he would also rise in the eyes of David by effecting this personal reconciliation between David and Absalom. And having done David such a great favor, this would indebt David to Joab and make him stronger politically. Less chance David would want to kick him out of the kingdom, which of course David did want to do, and in fact got his son to do. So Joab is doing stuff to make it impossible for David to get rid of him. David was not too fond of Joab, of course. Joab had treacherously killed Abner, almost messed up David's peace negotiations with the northern Benjamite kingdom as he was at Hebron trying to unite the kingdom. And as I said, on his deathbed, David told Solomon, take care, Joab, which happened. We'll get there. So that's political reasons. David doesn't like Joab. Maybe David will like Joab better if he reconciles Absalom. And also, there's no chance or less chance of a civil war. Actually, no chance if Absalom would come back. That's political reasons why Joab wanted to get Absalom back, but also personal reasons. Joab may actually have had personal feelings for Absalom. Maybe. That's a speculation. He might have had another reason. As John Gill suggests, Joab may have thought that if David could forgive Absalom's murder of Amnon, then David could also forgive Joab's murder of Abner, which happened earlier. Remember, Abner was the general of Saul's kingdom, Benjamite kingdom. Joab treacherously murdered him in Hebron. But for whatever reason, Joab really wanted to get Absalom back. Now, the next question we have is, did David do the right thing in pardoning Absalom? Well, there's two options here. Yes, he did, and no, he didn't. Yes, he did do the right thing, or no, he didn't do the right thing. Well, let's argue in favor of David. First of all, Absalom was provoked when he murdered Amnon. After all, Amnon had raped his sister, so it wasn't like a normal premeditated murder. It's more like justice. Also, David would be bringing Absalom back into a country where justice might be done. Absalom could get called before court. Absalom would never be brought to justice in Geshur. Well, against that, is that never happened, did it? Another reason why you might argue that David did the right thing in pardoning Absalom is that Absalom might be so influenced by heathenism up in Geshur that he might renounce God, so we need to bring him back. Another reason why you might justify David's bringing Absalom back to the kingdom is that David was doing something that was necessary politically. He avoided civil war. He appeased the unrest of the Hebrew people who were seeming to favor Absalom. And David would make his chief general Joab a lot happier. Well, those are all mitigations of David's error in pardoning Absalom. And so that takes us to the other option. Did he do the right thing? No, he did not do the right thing. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says. The king was bound by law to execute impartial justice on every murderer. Let's read some scriptures. Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Numbers 35:30-31. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. Well, did David surely put to death the murderer in his own household? No, he did not. And besides, if you want to justify what he did because he got rid of the threat of a civil war, really, well, it was a civil war that happened anyway. He brought him back to the kingdom, and the civil war followed, so that wasn't, again, I'm speaking from hindsight, but nonetheless, as it turned out, the plan to pardon Absalom did not work out too well for David. So, in my humble opinion, David should have executed justice as the law required. Numbers 35:30-31. Now, verse 23 says, Joab goes up to Geshur to fetch Absalom. Absalom's staying with his grandfather there, the king of Geshur. We read in 2 Samuel 13:37. Now, Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. Talmai's the granddaddy. He has a daughter named Maacah who married David and had Absalom. So, Maacah is the mother, and Absalom is the son of the mother, the grandson of Talmai. We go now to 2 Samuel 14:24. However, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and did not see the king's face. Now, let's look at some reasons why David might not have wanted to see Absalom. First of all, it would show how disgusted he was with Absalom's crime. He didn't want his mercy to Absalom to be misinterpreted. People would say, David led Absalom back, therefore it's okay to murder your brother. Especially considering there has got to be a portion of the population who wanted Absalom to be punished, and David's bringing him back. So David's kind of splitting the difference here. He says, well, I'm not going to continue to punish him as bad as I had by bringing him to exile, so I'll bring him back to Jerusalem, but I'm not going to let him be a part of the court. I'm not even going to talk to him. David also might not have wanted his mercy to Absalom to be misinterpreted by Absalom himself. Absalom may not have been humbled enough for his crime, and as the story proceeds in later chapters, I would say that's probably true. He was not humble, and maybe David was thinking, I'll humble him some more by not letting him show his face at court. So this is more than a private family matter. This is public justice here, and so that's why David's not seeing him. If you ask me, it was a good thing he didn't see him. I don't think he should have brought him back from... I think he should have executed him, quite frankly. But anyway, he's still trying to play lip service, at least, to the fact that he is the chief arbiter of justice in the kingdom. We go down to 2 Samuel verses, chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. Now in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. When he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. It's a lot of ink spilled on somebody's hair. I'm trying to think. Maybe the reason was is because it explains how Absalom got his handsome head of hair caught in the branches of that tree where he hung himself at the end of his life, which we'll get to shortly. At any rate, or it could be just talking about how handsome his hair was because he was a handsome man. And why is that a big deal? Well, because physical appearance always factors itself into a leader's charisma and ability to lead. You recall that Saul was tall, 1 Samuel 9:2. He, that's Kish, had a son named Saul, an impressive young man. There was no one more impressive among the Israelites than he. He stood a head taller than anyone else. David was handsome and ruddy, the next king, 1 Samuel 16:12. So Jesse sent for him. He had beautiful eyes and a healthy, sometimes translated ruddy, handsome appearance. Jameson Fawcett and Brown said that Absalom's, quote, high spirit and courtly manners, unquote, made him popular. The 200 shekels, by the way, is about 5 pounds of hair every year Absalom cut off. We go down to 2 Samuel 14, verse 27. To Absalom there were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. Now these 3 sons probably all died young since their names are not given in the future, and also since in another place in Samuel it is said that Absalom had no sons, 2 Samuel 18:18. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to preserve my name. So I have no son to preserve my name. His beautiful daughter Tamar was named after her aunt, Absalom's sister, Tamar, the one who had been raped by Amnon. The Septuagint adds an interesting detail, says that Tamar Jr., the daughter of Absalom, not the sister, the daughter, had married Solomon's, or will marry, Solomon's son Rehoboam. I don't know if that's true or not. We go down to 2 Samuel 14, verses 28 and 29. Now Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he, the king, David, would not come to him, would not come to Absalom. So Absalom sent again a second time, but he, David, would not come. Now Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that, in their opinion, David showed great wisdom. Whatever error David might have made in bringing Absalom back to Jerusalem, the error is mitigated by David not going to see Absalom. Now, why did this show wisdom? Well, it might help bring Absalom to repentance. It would be to show that the people that a crime had been committed, and David was not going to take it so lightly as to let Absalom off the hook completely. He's kind of splitting the difference here. He's not executing Absalom, but he's exiling Absalom. I don't think that's a good idea, in my humble opinion. Now, Absalom was completely ostracized. No courtiers went to see him, as Jameson, Fox, and Brown say. And that's a pretty miserable existence. If you want to be king, if you're the heir to the throne, and nobody's even talking to you, not even the chief general, Joab. Joab would not come to see him, to see Absalom. David had made Absalom persona non grata to everybody in the kingdom, and it wouldn't look right for Joab, the chief general, to be siding with Absalom. So Absalom didn't come. Perfectly understandable. It could be also that he had felt he'd already done enough for Absalom. He already got him brought back to Jerusalem. He didn't want to be inconvenienced any further. Or it could be that Joab wanted to see if there was any remorse on Absalom's part for killing Amnon, but I don't think Joab cared too much about that. I think he was just, basically, he was doing the politically right thing to do. The king doesn't want you to see Joab, so I'm not going to go see Joab. We go now to 2 Samuel 14, verses 30 through 33, and we will finish this chapter. Therefore he, Absalom, said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and said to him, "Why have your servants set my field on fire?" Except he probably said it in a tone a lot more angry than that. Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent for you, saying, 'Come here, that I may send you to the king, to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me still to be there. Now therefore let me see the king's face, and if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.'" So when Joab came to the king and told him, he, the king, David, called for Absalom. Then Absalom came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. How touching. So Absalom, he can't see the king, so he comes up with this trick, if you will, by setting Joab's field on fire. That's going to make Joab come talk to him, because Joab wouldn't come talk to him before. John Gill says this, quote, shows Absalom to be a bold and revengeful and ungrateful man, to use his friend and the general of the king's army after this manner. Yeah, you burn his field down. It's lucky Joab didn't get angry and come over there and chop his head off. And notice that Absalom's servants, the same servants who had killed Amnon, now they're burning down Joab's field. These people don't care about people's life or property. His servants were just about as evil as Absalom. Now, Absalom tells Joab, "Hey, I might as well have stayed up at Geshur than come down here. I'm isolated. Nobody talks to me. It'd be better if I was still up at Geshur." As John Gill says, quote, "where he lived in a king's court and had honor and respect shown him, suitable to his rank, and where he had his liberty and could go where he pleased, and where this mark of his father's displeasure, not suffering him to see his face, would not be so manifest as here in Jerusalem, and so less disgraceful to him." In other words, if he had been up at Geshur, people would have been still talking to him, showing him honor and respect. It wouldn't look like his father is picking on him by not seeing him. And so actually, Joab is probably saying the truth. He would be better off in Geshur. And then he says, "Hey, let me see David. If there's iniquity in me, let David put me to death." Now, do you think Absalom was really afraid of being put to death? No, John Gill says. Here's some possible reasons. One, he felt he was justified in killing the rapist Amnon. Now, I would humbly submit to you that I think that if he did think that Absalom was wrong to think that he was justified to kill somebody in cold blood. The case never went through proper legal procedure. The murder was an act of private revenge. Private revenge is always actionable at law. So he wasn't justified, but he might have felt like he was. So he might have felt like, well, David's not going to put me to death for what I did. And not surprising, because David had done nothing to come track him down in Geshur. He just let him go. So he wasn't afraid of being put to death. Absalom also knew his father's attitude towards him had softened. He had led him back in the country. And he'd been in the country for 2 years, and David hadn't done anything, so obviously David wasn't planning to kill him. So this was a bunch of extreme statement here. "Let him put me to death if there's iniquity in me. I don't care." He's just talking big. He's basically saying, "I'm willing to risk my life by going to see David. That's how much I want to see him." But he's not really risking his life. He's just talking like he's risking his life. But Joab said, okay, went and told David. David said, okay, call for Absalom. And so they softened. So David kisses Absalom in verse 33, and as a reward for that wonderful act of reconciliation, peace and love and harmony, Absalom fomented a civil war. So we'll start on that in the next chapter, when we see Absalom's conspiracy taking place in chapter 15. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.